Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Kreisman, and it's such a pleasure to be joined today by Melissa Chadburn. Her writing has appeared in the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times Book Review, and many other publications. Her extensive reporting on the child welfare system appears in the Netflix docuseries, The Trials of Gabriel Fernandez. She's a PhD candidate in creative writing at USC and lives in Greater Los Angeles. And her debut novel is called A Tiny Upward Shove. Welcome, Melissa.
Hi, welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So in your author bio, this is always the best way to start. You have reported on the child welfare system, and it appears that your reporting has really informed your novel. Tell me a little bit about that.
I think this novel has just been such a long project. It's a lifelong project, really. But so while I was working on it, I was also reporting towards the end. I was reporting on this particularly harrowing case in LA County, and right sort of at the end of the case, it became this Netflix docuseries. And I just remember sitting in the courtroom at the end when the parents were sentenced in that case, and it really made me trouble my ideas of like justice and mercy. And I do write, nonfiction, I write journalism, I write fiction. And whenever I set out to write a narrative, I'm like, what's the best container for that story? You know, and in this case, I wanted to tell the whole story of a whole life. And I felt like fiction allowed me to do that in a way that I wasn't able to do that with her straight reporting, we're kind of confined to both sideism and objectivism and all these other ideas, and with reporting where we're not so limited with fiction.
You can tell the story you want to.
Yes.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
No one has a business like yours with all its strengths and challenges. To succeed, you need a hiring partner that adapts to your needs. You need Indeed. Indeed is the hiring platform for where you can attract, interview, and hire all in one place. Instead of spending hours on multiple job sites searching for candidates with the right skills, Indeed's a powerful hiring partner that can help you do it all. Find greater talent faster through time-saving tools like Indeed Instant Match assessments and virtual interviews. With Instant Match, over 80% of employers get quality candidates whose resume on Indeed matches their job description the moment they sponsor a job, according to Indeed data. Indeed does the hard work for you. When you pay to post a job, Instant Match shows you candidates whose resumes on Indeed fit your description immediately after you post, so you can hire faster. Even better, Indeed's the only job site where you only pay for applications that meet your must-have requirements. Join more than 3 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Start hiring now with a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/Maris. Offer good for a limited time. Claim your $75 credit now at Indeed.com/Maris. Indeed.com/Maris. Terms and conditions apply. Pay per qualified applicant not available for all users. Need to hire? You need Indeed. And you get to have a supernatural element.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, yeah, I just, that allowed me to enter other people's minds and memories and have other multiple memories and points of view in a way. And for me, that that was like a tool towards empathy, a way for people to build empathy in their care through these other folks and these other characters by having access to their memories.
Tell me a little bit about the lore of the, and I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing this, Aswang?
Aswang, yeah.
Yeah.
So the Aswang is, I just love the Aswang. I think that she's so badass, but she is a figure sort of born out of colonialism. And depending on who you ask, like somebody might tell you that she's a vampire or a shapeshifter or like a werewoman. So, you know, but truly she is a figure born out of colonialism in that this is a matriarchy in a space where women had a lot of power and healing practices and sexual prowess. And I just felt like I wanted to just capture women's strength. And it seemed like the best way to bestow either revenge or mercy and to kind of personify what it is that I consider to be justice would be by way of the Aswang. I mean, even today though, there are folks who really truly believe in the Aswang. You know, you can read in Filipino Inquirer and Philippine Inquirer like, oh, this alleged Aswang was murdered. So, you know, I think that some people really subscribe to the concept of Aswang, but I think that perhaps we all have our inner Aswang.
Love that. And through the Aswang, you get to really portray this intergenerational, I don't even want to say trauma. At one point you say in the narrative that Marina's lineage is a battlefield. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that and how the Aswang is able to piece it all together.
I don't know. I guess it's so funny. I've been in edits on this book for so long that I'm almost a different person than the one who started it, you know, and I've entered this new phase of life, you know, like I remember like kind of a couple of years ago being like having access to this emotion that I wasn't familiar with at all. I was like, what is that? And it was rage, like intense rage. And I was like, this is one sort of, it feels like ancient, like it feels like something that I had access to from generations past. And it feels exciting too. Like, I don't feel like I've had access to this kind of rage in a long time, but it also feels like so I guess in that sense, like, the Aswang is intergenerational, but it's like a power that I think can be brought down from person to person. I've been thinking a lot about Toni Morrison used this term rememory in reference to the intergenerational sort of trauma, or what people have called like post-trauma of the genocide of Black people in slavery. And I feel like in that sense, like, and she uses the phrase rememory as opposed to post-memory that's often used in Holocaust studies, because there is no post, like this is an ongoingness, right, to this trauma, like it's we're still in it sort of. And and so I think that in that sense, like, I think the Aswang figure is able to work through, there's like no post-colonialism, you know. I think that it's an ongoingness still to colonialism. And I think I was also trying to exhibit the multiple breakdowns within society, like our foster care system and economic violence and you know, the an addiction and well, I use this serial killer figure in Canada. So I feel like I wanted to point out these other like slow forms of killing that have got are current and ongoing in society.
Yes. And it really struck me that you talk about this serial killer, Willie Picton, who is based on a real person who did these killings. But you really give him a backstory and you really allow our gaze to linger on him. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, in the at the time, there were like multiple serial killers operating in this same area along the Lougheed Highway that runs from the Pacific Northwest to Canada. And so I did want to call attention to that just because like one of the first essays that I published that got any attention was called The Throwaways. And it was about taxes, but it was also about the foster care system and people in the margins and people who are construed as throwaways. And so I did want to bring attention. And I think that's part of my larger project that I'm interested in. But so I do want to bring attention to that. But, you know, unfortunately, like the world isn't so clean in that there are like good people and bad people. You know, I mean, the truth is the most interesting story, but the truth is really complicated as Picton. So I think I was hoping to just bring a fully fleshed, you know, broader depiction of this person.
Yeah, and you certainly don't shy away from writing about the difficult things, the explicit violence or trauma. I wonder if you could tell me about writing like that, the kind of not looking away. Mm-hmm. And also, how do you take care of yourself as you're writing this stuff?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many different takes on this, but in terms of looking away or not looking away, like I always remember this time when I was hiking with some friends in Northern California, and we came upon a deer with a broken leg. And, you know, one of the people who was on the hike was like nature guy. And, you know, he put the deer out of her misery and with a rock. But the right prior, he was like, "Don't look." And of course, my main instinct is to look. Like, I want to look. Like, I am just of the mind that there are people out there doing terrible things all the time, and I want to know about it. And I want to look. Like, I'm constantly engaged in that. And I think also because it's like, who's to determine what's harm or what's, like I said, I'm always interested in like the slow forms of killing. It's like, I'd written about this a while ago. I wrote about this like literary grifter, and everybody was like, "Yes, I love a grifter. Everybody loves a grifter story," you know? And I was like, well, I've always written about grifters. I write about, you know, capitalism all the time. Like, what do you think capitalism is? It's grifting. So, but, you know, in that respect, like, I'm interested in looking at these dark spaces, but, and also, you know, as someone who has experienced economic violence and physical violence and sexual violence, it's like, these things happen. And so, you know, it just seemed very likely that these things would occur within this character's trajectory. So I included it. In terms of self-care, you know, I watch copious amounts of garbage television. I love reality TV. It's particularly like the Housewives franchise.
Okay, that could.
Another thing that happened during the Gabriel Fernandez docuseries came out like right after the shelter in place orders were. So it was like first, all these people were talking about this thing that I care so deeply about that I was really excited about people talking about. And then we were sent to shelter in place. And then I was also getting all these like messages on social media about other kids who are in unsafe situations all across the country. And my first inclination was to just, you know, put on my cape and fly over to the place and write about this incident. And so in some sense, like perhaps it was good for me to, in terms of self-care, to what better thing to do after you do a long project like that and it becomes public than to like, you know, be wrapped up in blankets and watch TV and like sit by the fireplace. And like, so in that sense, it was some form of self-care. It's like, I'm experiencing that now with the novel, which is, it's about to be out in the world. And, but I think its platonic ideal for me was already realized, like when I held it in my hands, you know. Mm-hmm. Now I have to like, consider what people's reception of it is, and what would be lovely is if like I could just like be wrapped up in blankets instead of like gonna go places and talk to people about it.
I mean, the when the book is no longer in your control, that's when blankets come in handy.
Yeah, exactly.
But I really like the story about the deer because the title of the book, mm-hmm. A Tiny Upward Shove, comes from a scene of mercy. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Oh, the bird, the poor bird. Mm-hmm. So the titular chapter, Marina, our protagonist, is in her Lola's garage, her grandmother's garage, and she's waiting for her mom to get ready to go out. And her mom comes in, Mucha, and comes into the garage and notices, was wondering what's taking Marina so long, and Marina's mentioning that there's a bird that's stuck in the stuck in like a water heater or something, and she's saying, you know, the bird won't get out, and she keeps on putting her finger below the bird's feet going, you know, step up, which is something that she saw at a local pet shop. The bird isn't coming out, and so finally Marina's mother just stomps down the stairs and socks the bird upwards, and so it'll fall down. And she said, you know, we've just done what we've always done, honey. We give it a tiny shove upwards. Marina's like devastated, like, what did you do? She's like looking at this bird that's dying on the, and she's wondering what happened. And I don't know. I mean, again, it is like that deer scene. It's like, there's only one thing to do. Mm-hmm. It's like, put things on the other end of the precipice, you know?
Absolutely. And tell me a little bit about writing Marina, and certainly the reader is able to see that she is not living under the best of circumstances, but as a character, as a kid, Marina doesn't necessarily know what she doesn't know. Tell me about writing from that perspective.
Yeah, I mean, well, isn't that true? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like, we don't know. I similar to Marina, you know, a favorite pastime of mine has always been to like look in at people's dining rooms and just be like, how did they get there? Like, how did they do that? You know, people like, there were always like construction sites. I grew up in Los Angeles around the same time Marina did. And it was like in the 80s, there were all these like condos being built everywhere. Like all the apartment buildings were being taken down and these big condos were being built. And so there were always these construction sites and I would play in these empty sites, but then also whatever erected in their place, I spent a lot of time like looking in and being like, what does that look like? Or, you know, even being in different suburbs where there people had homes, like whole homes with upstairs and downstairs. And but I just remember like looking in the living rooms and dining rooms rather, and seeing like, you know, there might be a piano or like a bowl of fruit or a cat. And I was just like, how did they get that? Like, how did they get there? And so I think I always knew on some level that I had lived differently from other people, but I didn't know if it was like if there was a wrong or a right way. I think also Los Angeles put me in proximity to kids of all different classes because I grew up really poor, but like the kids without supervision were either really wealthy or really poor. And so we would like all kind of come together. and so I didn't have like a real clear barometer of like what's appropriate or inappropriate.
Hey guys, I want to tell you about a product I'm using literally every day. I started taking AG1 because just with everything going on in my life, I am really bad about consistently taking vitamins. The best part, it doesn't taste like it's super healthy. It's kind of a mild tropical taste that I actually look forward to each morning. So what's in this stuff? In one delicious scoop of AG1, you're absorbing 75 high quality vitamins, minerals, whole food sourced superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens to help you start your day right. Special blend of ingredients supports your gut health, your nervous system, your immune system, your energy, recovery, focus, and aging. All the things. Which is great for someone like me who's always on the go, especially with all my running. It's really important that I'm getting my daily source of vitamins. But just because I'm so scatterbrained and organized chaos, I just completely forget unless I have something that just really makes it straightforward to get everything I need. And AG1 is lifestyle friendly, whether you eat keto, paleo, vegan, dairy-free, or gluten-free. And the best part, because while maybe I don't say I'm a healthy eater, at the same time, I really do focus on what I eat, that the fact that it contains less than 1 gram of sugar, no GMOs, and no nasty chemicals or artificial anything while still tasting good is really important to me. And the extra benefit is it supports better sleep quality and recovery. It also supports mental clarity and alertness. And that's because Athletic Greens uses the best of the best products based on the latest science with constant product iterations and third-party testing. And best of all, it only costs you less than $3 a day. You're investing in your health, and it's cheaper than your cold brew habit. You're investing in all-in-one nutritional insurance. And because I said I really do care about where the things I consume come from, Athletic Greens is a climate-neutral certified company. In 2020, AG purchased carbon credits that supports projects protecting old-growth rainforest, as well as donating to organizations that help to get nutritious food to kids in need, including No Kid Hungry here in the U.S. In 2020, AG donated over 1.2 million meals to kids. And right now, you can reclaim your health too and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition. Just one scoop and a cup of water every day. That's it. No need for a million different pills and supplements to look out for your health. To make it easy, Athletic Greens is giving you one free year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/Maris. Again, that is athleticgreens.com/Maris. Take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance.
And I do love there are certain things that Marina goes back to, that we go back to as readers, even positive moments to kind of clutch when things get really hard. And, you know, we're made to know many times that Marina's mother helped her use her inhaler or took her out on, how do you refer to it? It sounds so fun going to different diners and toasting your own bread.
Casing toast, yes.
Casing toast. And of course I understand like that lightness needs to be there, but tell me about dealing with that weight.
I mean, so, you know, I always, I had a good friend point this out to me once, but like, I always say the crisis for Marina, and then, and I'll also just say like for myself, like the crisis wasn't like entering foster care or, you know, losing a brother, or addiction, or for me, the crisis was like a very universal one, which is that when I grew up, like I loved everyone and everything. Like I loved my mailbox, I loved my teacher, I loved the bus driver, I loved the person who worked at the liquor store. Like I just like, I loved everyone and everything, and I assumed they all loved me back. And so the crisis is the day you realize that that's not true, you know? And I think that's true for most folks, especially Marina. But we also often like, you know, have this moment, like have all this time where like our parent is a, or at least Marina did, her parent, her mother was her superhero, you know, she was just like stunning and she loved to dance to the Bee Gees and taught her how to like kick a guy where it counts and, you know, taught her these police codes and like, you know, she was just this, her world. And then there is a point, I think, when Marina realizes she's human.
And of course, the fact that the book takes place in the 80s and 90s reflects on the way that the world once was, the way the system once was. I'm wondering if you could tell me about writing that time and also like if anything has changed, if I mean, if for the better, if anything has improved, because yes, things change.
I'm like, well, we have internet. I don't know. yeah, I mean, I think that that was like a super, it was an important time to capture. Certainly it was a really, I'll just say like, it was a really important time for the child welfare system. And I wish there was a less complicated way to say this, but I will say that when welfare reform occurred, when Bill Clinton changed welfare to temporary assistance to needy families, all the services that people used to get from Department of Public Social Services, they suddenly were referred to now the Department of Children and Family Services, which made caseloads, you know, double, triple, quadruple, and put a lot of children in harm's way. And so in that way, that really shifted our child welfare system. And then there has been, and always probably has been, but even more so now, a large movement towards privatization of the child welfare system. And so I think that that is one thing to be wary of or to be aware of. But in terms of overall, I've only engaged really super closely with the last 5 or 6 years within LA County's child welfare system. I'm doing like a close reading of these case files of children who have died within the child welfare system in LA County. But in the last, but I will say that one thing that's been pretty constant is this, the pendulum that the system runs on, which is like either when in doubt, yank them out, or like extreme, or like a rigorous family preservation. And so I think that that's always been the trend and a pendulum, and it's mostly swung by high profile cases that have been reported upon. And I don't know about, like, there are some really thrilling long-term interventions that I think respond to that initial wound. You know, like whenever I'm kind of in a funky mood, I'm like, what's wrong? And I have to think about, like, or if I have like a larger response to something than I ought to, like if somebody cuts me off and I'm like, have a huge response. And I will often think about like, what's the original wound that I'm responding to here? And so in terms of the child welfare system, I think the original wound was welfare reform. And so a right-sized response would be something that addresses that. And right now we're seeing a lot of like universal basic income programs and guaranteed income programs that I think are super exciting for that. And hopefully that will make some positive shift.
And amidst so much darkness that you write about, I feel like I need to express to listeners that this book is really funny. This little section when Marina's Lola gives a list of advice on like how a girl should be, like I felt like it was like a Filipino version of Girl by Jamaica Kincaid. Mm-hmm. Yes. Tell me about writing The Joy.
Oh yeah, pork is a seasoning, right? That's like a real thing. Like I remember I had told my grandmother once, like I had people coming over and I'm like, they're vegetarian, grandma, like, don't give them any meat. And so she made mac and cheese and she put like cut up hot dog in it. And I was like, Lola, there's hot dog. And she says, pork is a seasoning. That's not meat, that's pork. Pork is a seasoning. grandmothers are great. They're so fun. I hope that this is seen as like a love letter to Lolas everywhere because they're just so neat and scary, but like funny. So I hope that comes across.
Absolutely. And tell me a little bit about the character of Sabina and representing her portion of the story. So I found that there was something particularly devastating in a devastating book that takes place for her.
What's like the most devastating sense for me is like longing. There's so irreparable, you know, what do you do with this longing? And I'm in my qualifying exams right now. So I'm like, but I've been doing a lot of thinking about unbearability and like, especially as it relates to motherhood and maternity and like the tactile sense of unbearability, like the weight of it. And I think Sabina certainly represents that. There's a song. I'm thinking of this now because it was like in like an earlier version of my prospectus, but I like had too much fun writing about it and I had to take it all out. But that Kate Bush song, This Woman's Work, it was like remade by Maxwell, but Kate Bush's song, This Woman's Work, and she initially wrote it for this film in the 80s. She's having a baby, and like Kevin Bacon is in the waiting room while his wife is in labor, and so they play the song, and behind and over this montage of like this couple like laughing and playing and painting the house and this and that and the other, and like the words are, you know, I think that the idea is that he has to now grow up and be a man because he's gonna have a child, and also though the idea is that the wife is possibly not gonna make it, the child is possibly not gonna make it, and the wife is possibly not gonna make it, and he's asking, and in the song the lines are like, make it go away, and so it's like also at the same time he's asking her to remove the pain while she's dying of his grief, to like remove this burden from him. And so I guess but the song also makes me cry all the time, and I really enjoy crying sometimes. And and I'm bringing all this up because you know, I think that Sabina sort of represents that figure of someone who has survived the unbearable and wanting it to, you know, that whole like make it go away thing, you know, I think is something that is it's relatable. It's a also one of the original wounds, I'd imagine, and anyone who has experienced maternal loss can probably vibe with her. So that's that.
Yeah. Well, this has been really wonderful. Tiny upward shove. Thank you, Melissa. Before we go, do you have any books you'd like to recommend for us?
Yes. Yes, I would. Well, I love, love Jessamyn Shin's School of Good Mothers. She, in her acknowledgments also, she acknowledges Betsy Bartholet, who is a Harvard law professor who has done a lot of work against the privatization of foster care system. And so I felt like it was, but it's just such a beautiful book talking about longing and maternal longing and loss. And since I'm dissertating right now, I cannot wait to jump all the way into Disorientation by Elaine Chao.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
You too.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.